Inoho, please be seated.
Mr. Moore.
Thank you, Your Honour. Now, just before the morning tea break, we were just starting to explore the discretionary activity and how that might work in the context of both trust power and other potential applicants in relation to hydroelectricity generation. And we had reached the point where the consideration of those applications and the question of how those applications might be considered in terms of the policy guidance through PC7 might occur. Now, I can assure you we are going to get to that particular point, but I want to deal with the regional policy statement provisions first, and then we'll drop back into the drafting provisions or the drafting, but I can flag that that's certainly something that we will be exploring a little more detail. So in relation to the regional policy statement, you have referred to objective 4.4 of that document, and you have set out policy 4.4 at paragraph 6.12 of your evidence in chief.
Yes.
And when you look at objective 4.4, that objective does not say anything about consent duration?
Not explicitly, no.
And insofar as Plan Change 7 is providing a framework within which hydroelectricity generation can be reconsented, it is providing for that activity?
It provides a framework within which all activities are to be considered, but it doesn't, in my opinion, recognise hydro as a specific activity as this objective and its associated policies expect.
Do you read recognise in this context to mean prioritise hydroelectricity use over other uses?
No, I do not, but recognise comes under the heading of provide for. So, in my opinion, you've got to do something obvious to recognise and provide for something, not just have it in amongst everything else.
So when you now think about the recommended restricted discretionary activity rule, that is enabling the treatment of hydroelectricity schemes perhaps differently to other activities?
That is enabling the circumstances that hydroelectricity schemes have in relation to their water meter data to be recognised more appropriately in establishing what actual historical use is through that RDA pathway.
You then in your evidence go on in your paragraph 613 to provide the text for objective, let me just get this right, it's the text from policy 4.43.
443, yes.
Yes. And again, when you look at the wording within that policy, it doesn't speak to consent duration.
Not explicitly, no.
And insofar as the chapeau of that policy applies, it's about protecting the generation output of existing infrastructure.
Correct, yes.
And again, the generation output of existing infrastructure is protected by enabling the reconsenting of the historical rates of take through Plan Change 7.
The RDA pathway provides for that recognition of historical use to protect that capacity under the deemed permits, yes.
and that policy does not refer to new hydroelectricity generation activities?
No, that one's specific to existing.
And there isn't, for completeness, a policy dealing with new hydroelectricity generation in the RPS?
Policy 441, which was the one above, is not explicit to new or existing. It covers both.
Yes. To move on to paragraph 7.4 of your evidence in chief now. And in this paragraph you are drawing a distinction between different types of uses, different activities.
Yes.
And you've noted that there's a different higher order policy framework that applies to renewable electricity generation.
Yes.
And then the final sentence of that paragraph over the page, you note that such activities, and I'm assuming you're referring to renewable electricity generation, should be recognised for their different uses of water and managed differently through provisions where it can achieve all relevant legislative requirements. Isn't what you're speaking about in this paragraph the decision around allocation of the resource between different and often competing uses?
No. What I was trying to highlight here is that Plan Change 7 treats all activities equally, and at the time I wrote this evidence in chief, many months ago now, the relief that we were seeking was to specifically recognise hydroelectricity generation activities throughout the plan change as being different. Obviously, things have moved on now, and the framework which has been evolving and has come out of the joint witness statement has enabled changes that I don't believe any longer need hydro to be explicitly taken out and run parallel. What I was trying to say at that point in time was simply what I've said about lumping everything together doesn't recognise the functional and fundamental differences between something like irrigation and hydro.
Right, so those concerns have now been addressed through the drafting that's come forward in the joint witness statement.
As I said in my summary, that has covered some of the issues. What we didn't cover in conferencing was duration, and so I've given my views on that again.
Do you accept that allocation of water resources for long durations has the potential to allocate the water?
Do you mean a resource consent?
Yes.
For a long duration?
Yes.
It allocates the right to use water under the conditions of that consent?
And insofar as that consent is in force, that water can't be allocated to a different user?
That's my understanding, unless there's some mechanism within a specific consent.
And so if in the future the land and water plan to come sets in place a flow and allocation regime that allocates water amongst a number of competing uses, if all of the water has already been allocated to hydroelectricity generation through a long-term permit, then that flow and allocation regime would be frustrated until the point in time that the hydroelectricity permit expires.
What I'm not sure of is the ability to do a review of consents to enable recognition of changes that come in the future. So I understand the purpose of the Act in allowing review is to recognise that things move on. What I don't know and would need legal advice obviously on is the ability, how far that ability to review consents extends when things change over time.
So just to test that, so assuming that the legal position is that water cannot be reallocated as a result of a consent review, and I say reallocated to a different use, then the effect of the existing long-term allocation, or do you accept that the effect of the existing long-term allocation to one use would frustrate the implementation of a new flow and allocation regime?
Yes, if that's not built into a consent at the time that it's considered.
Are you saying in order for a consent to be reviewed, you need to build into the consent decision or the conditions of consent a review clause that says will be reviewed in accordance with a new flow and allocation regime?
That wasn't what was on my mind, Your Honour.
I was
thinking that in terms of a consent that was seeking a longer term, that conditions could be built into that may have, for example, trigger points or references upon which you might review what is going on in the nature of that if it was over a very long term where you knew that changes in things like allocation may come in or changes in other circumstances around how that consent might be considered, including environmental. So it's very case specific.
Yeah, that probably was the same question I think as I put to you. So you're saying that unless there is a review condition, just say the change in the plan to come is not change in terms of allocation from the four water bodies in relation to which Trustpower draws its water, but so it's not a change in allocation, divide that between irrigation and hydro gets it, but it is a change in flow regime. So instead of taking everything out, you start from the proposition of you can only draw water when flows in the river are whatever they are. So it's a flow regime. Are you saying that you cannot review a resource consent if the new land and water plan puts into place a flow regime unless there's a condition of consent that says that you can?
No, I'm not saying that.
Right.
I thought the question that I was being given was whether you could review something to allocate it to someone else.
Oh, I see.
Whereas
yep.
yours is essentially allocating it to the environment,
yep.
which is a different proposition, as I understand it, under the Section 128 review ability.
Is that causing you any concern, that proposition?
No.
But it's more the take it off hydro, give it to a different entity. That, you know, you're saying, not sure about that.
Sure about that. And not sure, particularly in the context of these trust power races where you're very high up in catchments, small amounts of water, considerable catchments and other users downstream, largely unaffected by the situation that is foremost in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you accept that with reference to the four high up in the catchment examples that you have on your mind, that the current regional plan for water does not establish a flow and allocation regime compliant with the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management?
That's my understanding, yes.
In your, I think it was your supplementary evidence, you attached a number of examples of planning frameworks from elsewhere in New Zealand highlighting how consent duration was dealt with in other situations?
Yes, yes, that was an appendix to my supplementary, appendix two.
So I'm at now your appendix two, and I'm looking at some of the examples that you had helpfully provided. In the context of the first of those documents, the Canterbury Land and Water Regional Plan, is it your understanding that a flow and allocation regime for the allocation and management of water had been established in relation to the water bodies from which water was being taken for hydroelectricity use?
I understand that the Canterbury Land and Water Plan has flow allocation regimes in place for many water bodies, but not all, and I don't know if it's covered all of the hydroelectricity users in that region. That was not the purpose for which these examples were provided.
You accept that each of these examples given will, the planning frameworks from within which these examples are taken are all different?
Yes.
And they, in terms of duration, the integrated way in which each plan works is important when considering the relevance or considering the application of the duration policies?
In all cases, the case specific to each region have attempted to deal with different scenarios, and that was my very point in providing these examples.
And turning over the page, there's an excerpt from the proposed Southland Land and Water Plan.
Yes.
That plan is still subject to appeal.
It is.
But you've highlighted there Policy 40.
Yes.
And there you'll see subparagraph 7, which pushes or suggests shorter duration where that will better enable implementation of a revised framework established in those sections, referring to the freshwater management units.
That clause 7 talks about shorter or longer durations to enable implementation of FMU outcomes.
Yes. Yep. And so the timing of the development of provisions for each FMU is, in this context, a relevant consideration?
My understanding of the Southland context is they have not completed that exercise, and so the ability to determine the right outcome is not yet in place.
And so that policy is indicating shorter term consents in that situation?
It's enabling the consideration of those where it's appropriate, or better enable implementation, I think is the words they use.
When you think about better enabling implementation, shorter term consents would better enable implementation of new flow and allocation regimes.
If an FMU required a significant change in a flow allocation regime, that required consent durations to be shorter than what would be in relative term, then that is one of the considerations that this policy directs consideration of.
Right. As promised, I do have some questions about the drafting that has been put forward, and the version that I'm looking at is the red and blue version attached to your supplementary evidence. Okay.
So the extracts that I put
yes.
together, not the other drafting?
Yes.
Because that all comes from...
It's the extracts.
Yeah.
And I want to start with the objective. So you have recommended the addition of the blue text at the bottom of the objective.
Yes, that comes from my previous evidence.
And you maintain the view that that wording is appropriate.
Yes.
So in relation to the use of the word importance of hydroelectricity generation, where have you taken the word importance from in terms of superior documentation? What is it you're seeking to capture in terms of importance?
The use of the word importance was trying to encapsulate the terms that are used in other documents that are around benefits of, significance of. I was trying to keep simple a relatively complex set of directions from other documents. You could replace that with other terms, such as significance, which may connect more closely with terminology used in other documents.
So, in a sense, you're seeking to capture the essence of the higher-order documents and the way in which hydroelectricity generation is referred to within those documents.
And recognised as being important in various ways.
Continuing on with that objective, I then see reference to community water supply, and I didn't recall reading any evidence that you have put forward in relation to community water supplies and the need to provide for them in the objective.
And I've noted that as my footnote, that I have included that text only insofar as to align with other evidence. I was trying to be helpful to the court in recognising that that has been put forward as having a different angle on it in a similar way to hydro does to irrigation. Just simply there for completeness.
So you are not recommending, and you haven't expressed your independent opinion as to the appropriateness of the inclusion of community water supply within the objective?
No, I have provided no evidence on community water supply. I'm simply trying to be complete.
We then move on to the policies, and again, presumably the same comment applies in terms of the reference to community water supply in each of the policies where that phrase is used.
Exactly the same with the same footnote.
I'm looking now at policy 10A2.2, and the additional text here in blue, unless the take and or use is for hydroelectricity generation. Now, this policy would apply to all hydroelectricity generation that is the subject of a deemed permit.
That's my intent, yes.
And again, you don't have any working knowledge of the other hydroelectricity generation that might be captured by this wording in the policy.
Correct.
And when you refer to hydroelectricity generation in this policy, are you referring to that being the exclusive use of water or just one of the uses of water?
No, I'm referring to that as the activity that's under consideration.
So, insofar as there might be some ambiguity in the wording, if the wording was adjusted to refer to the water being used exclusively for hydroelectricity generation, that would be consistent with the outcome that you were intending?
That's more explicit, but I don't think there's ambiguity. It simply says the take is and or use is for.
So how would you then consider the use of water through a dam that is used for a mix of purposes, say irrigation and hydroelectricity generation, and a combination thereof? Where does that activity fit?
Well, that's something that the council has to work through at a processing level when they get an application and determine what the activity sought is for.
Do you foresee that there could be calls for argument as to whether or not that activity is envisaged by this policy in light of the wording you've recommended?
It's possible.
And insofar as your intention is that it's only water taken and used exclusively for hydroelectricity generation, isn't it better to be really explicit in the policy about that?
Yes.
Now, you refer also in your text back to consideration of the duration to be in accordance with Policy 6419 of the Operative Regional Water Plan?
Yes, I do.
And that plan, you say, does not give effect to the MPSREG?
That plan does not give effect to the REG.
So when you read Policy 6419, is it your opinion that policy would likely result in significantly long-term consents being granted for hydroelectricity generation?
I don't think that's a presumption that can be made. That's a functional policy which provides a series of considerations to be turned to when considering durations of a consent. And my purpose of linking that was to not have duration completely open-ended and unbound by anything, but to use some mechanism. And I simply did not wish to put a whole series of considerations which you might turn your mind to within these policies and overly complicate them.
Are you and do you have any experience with the practical application of Policy 6419 in the Otago region?
I do not.
If the practical application of that policy has resulted in long-term consents being granted for most activities, would that change the way in which you have approached inclusion of that policy or reference to the policy?
I don't think so, because that policy does not direct long term. It simply directs a consideration, and that comes down to how that policy and the consideration is implemented on a case by case basis. Simply saying that has occurred in the past does not, in my view, mean it has to occur in the future.
Consistent application of policy, though, is an important consideration.
It is, but things change, and so should implementation.
You then go on to make some similar or perhaps precisely the same recommendations in relation to Policy 10A 2.3.
Yes, that's the same.
Insofar as these policies apply to new applications for water to be taken for hydroelectricity generation, you accept that the outcome of the drafting that you have put forward would enable consideration of a 35-year term for a water permit?
It would enable consideration of any duration up to 35 years on a case-by-case basis against those parameters.
When you look at the objective and the policies in Plan Change 7, does the objective or the policies, let's put that in, are those the only objectives and policies, except for the duration policy, that would be considered when an application for a discretionary activity was lodged under your discretionary activity rule?
The wording that has been used in the plan change makes that the case by using the term irrespective of other policies. So it limits consideration for renewals under this plan change to these policy provisions.
In relation to the potential for long-term consents for renewals, does the objective or the policies provide any guidance as to the matters that should be taken into account when considering those applications?
Currently or with the amendments that I recommended?
With the amendments that you have recommended.
That's the entire purpose of referring back to the existing policy that allows consideration of key criteria for duration, because in the absence of that, these policies do not anticipate any longer than 6 years or give any parameters around what you might consider.
So let's put duration to one side just for a moment. Does the objective and the policies in Plan Change 7 provide any guidance as to the environmental outcomes that would need to be considered or achieved when processing an application for a long-term permit?
Not really, no.
And therefore, there's a policy vacuum in terms of how such an application might be processed.
In terms of effects?
Yes, so against what policy background Plan Change 7 would potential effects be considered?
Yes, that is true.
And from a planning perspective, that gap may result in unintended outcomes if there's no framework against which to assess effects.
It's certainly unhelpful in determining what effects are relevant under a fully discretionary activity status. Probably lead to over-assessment rather than under-assessment in my experience.
Is there a risk that it might go the other way, though, in the complete absence of any policy guidance?
There's always a risk.
The intention of your drafting to enable applications for new water permits for hydroelectricity generation to be sought for any duration, or is it, let's turn that into a question, is the intention of your drafting to enable applications for new water takes or water permits for hydroelectricity generation to be able to apply for any duration of consent?
Yes, that is my intent.
And when you think about the efficiency and effectiveness of those provisions, do you have in mind any particular scenarios?
I'm not sure what your questions.
So when you were thinking about the appropriateness of having no restriction on duration for new water permits, did you have in mind the trust power situation, or were you thinking more generally across the region that it's simply appropriate to enable long-term permits for hydroelectricity generation, full stop?
A bit of both. At the higher level, enabling the consideration to be given to appropriate duration, foremost in my mind was my knowledge of the trust power proposals and thoughts around enhancements and things like that, which come at substantial cost and I believe should be entitled to the conversation around what duration is appropriate on the merits of that new proposal or any new proposal that should come forward.
Except it's hard to predict what types of applications might be lodged in the future for hydroelectricity generation?
Yes.
There's a risk that a water resource from an allocative perspective could be locked up by the granting of a long-term permit for hydroelectricity generation?
There's a risk if it's not given due consideration through the consenting regime.
And in light of the planning framework to come, the very thing that Plan Change 7 is seeking to protect, isn't it more appropriate to ensure that activities that have the effect or may have the effect of locking up a resource for significant periods of time are not enabled?
I don't think it is necessary to make that determination at this point in all cases as a blanket response to uncertainties of what might be in a future plan that we don't know anything about yet.
Sorry, so that answer again, so it's not necessary in all cases?
In all cases to have a blanket response to duration to protect something in an unknown future plan.
Just let me think about that. What do you mean by that? It's not necessary in all cases. What do you mean by all cases?
So the plan change as currently put forward puts a blanket expectation of 6 years for all things, irrespective of what the activity is or the location. And in this I'm thinking of what Council have directed me to consider, which is the policy on new water takes. Mm. So that's where the questioning was. So what we don't know in the lifetime of this plan change is what new water take applications for hydro or otherwise will come along, but the presumption in this plan change is 6 years full stop. What I'm suggesting in the light of hydro is there's a good case to not take a blanket 6 year period, but to enable consideration through a consent process for more than 6 years if that is appropriate and can be managed through whatever the proposition is for that new water take. So it's about allowing opportunities to consider, not just...
Does that answer, though, hang off, if you like, or does that presuppose... or? Is that answer predicated on an operative plan, which is dealing appropriately with the integrated management of the water and land resource? Because if you had one of those, even with an MPS coming down the line, you know, a review under the MPS FM or even both the MPSs coming down the line, if you had a plan that was fit for purpose, it was a good working plan, as we understood it to be, prior to the 2020 NPS, in principle, you may have no difficulty with that. But do you have one of those, is my question.
Yeah, and that's something that is a particular issue when you get into the wider consents. Mm. And because I've been considering this quite narrowly in terms of hydro...
I'm thinking hydro, so I'm not thinking everybody else. So right. We're just looking at hydro. Do yep. you have a... the operative plan as it currently stands, does that adopt an integrated land and water management regime, which would have been appropriate under the superior documents as they stood prior to 2020?
I suspect not, but what is in my mind is that the applications that hydro go through are fully discretionary activities, which does enable a fairly broad consideration of all relevant aspects, regardless of whether the plan is particularly good at directing the outcomes expected or the ways to get there. The implementation is enabled to get the right outcomes.
Mm. So that's almost a philosophical discussion. You know, does a fully discretionary resource consent now for any activity allow you to get to the right answer if there's no policy imperative or direction given? So it's fully discretionary, so we'll get there in the end. Is that a philosophical issue, or is that a planning and legal issue?
There's a planning and legal element. I'll continue asking some questions.
Yeah.
Just to explore this a little further. Mm. So when you think about the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management, do you accept that that signals a paradigm shift in the way that freshwater is to be managed in New Zealand?
It signals an outcome that is to raise the priority in everyone's minds towards managing freshwater better than has been done in the past.
You accept it's... taking a water-centric approach, so looking at water and its inherent health and well-being and the inherent values first before looking at abstractive or allocative uses?
In the context of the NPSFM, that is its focus, but when preparing any kind of policy document, my understanding is that there's no governmental direction or higher order that you have to trump one thing over another. You have to consider all national policy statements and guidance together and figure out how to apply those in the circumstances of the policy you're writing. So within the bounds of the NPSFM, of course it's water-centric, but it is one of the documents that have to be considered together.
And in the context of plan-making functions of council, those documents must be given effect to?
That's the direction of the RMA.
And the operative water plan doesn't give effect to the NPS FM currently?
The operative water plan, in my opinion, gave partial effect to the NPS FM as it was back in the past. Everything's moved. Mm. You can't expect the operative water plan to give effect to current national guidance. That's why it has to catch up.
So when you're looking then at the risk of enabling a discretionary activity consent to be processed under the operative water plan, there's a risk that the paradigm shift encapsulated in the NPSFM 2020 won't be properly considered when processing a resource consent application?
That's an implementation risk which I can't help but think can be mitigated through the fact that when assessing consents, the consent authority is directed to take into account things like the national direction at the point in time of the consent that's being processed. So you still have to be assessing this application at the current point, not the past.
And when you think about the legal tests that apply with respect to national policy statements, In the planning context, it's a give effect to test.
Give effect to in preparing that document, yes.
And what's the legal test when considering a national policy statement when processing a resource consent application?
It's going to depend on your activity status. But under 104...
A discretionary activity then, which is what you're recommending in this context.
Yeah, so under 104 you still have to... Does it have regard to?
It's a lesser...
It's not give effect to. It's have regard to or take into account.
I think it's have regard to. I don't want to be put on the stand either, but I think that's right.
It's less than give effect to because the presumption is that the documents you are working under give effect to the higher order documents, which is, as we know, not always the case given the movement of time.
And do you accept that therein lies the problem with processing a discretionary activity through the lens of the operative water plan that doesn't give effect to the 2020 NPSFM in considering long-term permits?
I think having the operative plan out of date with the current position makes it harder for consent processing staff to tie things back to the operative plan, but they still are doing that processing in the light of having regard to the national direction as it stands.
If you think about this then from a risk perspective, there's a risk that the paradigm shift in the NPSFM is not appropriately considered through individual resource consent decisions, given the difference in legal test.
There's a risk. Yes.
And when you think about that risk, that's a risk of not giving effect to the national policy statement and what it's seeking to achieve. And should that risk be borne by the environment or by the abstractor being precluded from seeking a long-term consent?
It's very hard to respond in a philosophical situation with an unknown circumstance in play. There's a risk if implementation of consenting is not done well. There are all sorts of risks to the environment in its holistic sense, people and communities and natural environment. I'm not sure if I can give more than that without...
You accept it would be difficult to have regard to the NPS 2020 in a way that seeks to achieve its objective when the process for establishing flow and allocation regimes reflecting the hierarchy of priorities has not yet been undertaken?
Sorry, can you repeat?
Yeah, there were too many concepts there.
Yeah.
If you think about the NPSFM 2020, significant work is required by, in this context, the Otago Regional Council to put in place a planning framework that gives effect to the priorities set out in that document?
There's considerable work for the Regional Council to write the new water plan giving effect to all the national guidance, national direction.
There's a now highly prescriptive process set out in the NPSFM for establishing visions, environmental outcomes, values, limits.
There is.
And that work is yet to come in the Otago region?
As I understand it, that's underway.
And so an application lodged for resource consent in the absence of that information would be very difficult to capture the essence of the national policy statement through a consent application on a case-by-case basis.
A resource consent processed in advance of that work having been done cannot preempt what that outcome may be for the region or any catchment within it, but it can be cognizant of the NPS directions around the work that's happening and the need to prioritise water, amongst other things.
Thank you. No further questions.
Re-examination? Oh, no, sorry. Ms. Baker-Galloway.
My first set of questions are in relation to the joint witness statement on community water supplies that you attended, but I think your contribution was just in respect of the objective that was also...
I did not attend the community water supply one at all.
Oh, your name's on it.
Not on community water, hydro.
That I think it's titled community water supplies, but yes.
Really?
So it's the one dated 4 to 6 May.
The 4 to 6 May was the last planners and technical experts, big one.
Yeah, the big one.
Yeah.
That one, 4 to 6 May. So if you could just get that handy.
Yep.
And my questions are just in respect of the objective that was conferenced on. And I've just noted at paragraph 5, it's listed which of the experts supported version A. So it records you as supporting version A of the objective.
Correct, yes.
So if we go to the appendix where we see the two versions side by side.
Yes.
In fact, my first set of questions are on words that are the same in respect of both objectives, and that's the first sentence, to provide for an efficient and timely transition to a new land and water plan. And just picking up on a theme of Mr Moore's questioning of you, you were discussing with Mr Moore that in the event a long-term consent is granted, if it's required to be reviewed in order to give effect to the new land and water plan, then it can go through that consent. The council could initiate that consent review process to see whether or not changes are required to the resource consent.
That is my understanding, that is an option.
That is an option. But do you agree that is less efficient than the issue of the shorter term consents now? The implementation of the new land and water plan, and then the long-term consent going forwards in light of that?
I'm not sure that that's less efficient, because having a two-step consenting process is fairly daunting for many applicants and comes at a cost, both in terms of time and resources. So there's different implications with the two different approaches.
Mm. Sorry, I should have prefaced that a bit more carefully. With where things have got to now with the six-year controlled or restricted discretionary framework, do you agree that that's becoming closer to being an efficient rollover with minimal assessment of effects, or none, if you like, required. So,
yes.
Sorry, that's the starting point. We have an efficient six-year rollover.
Of the existing historical use for 6 years one or other of those pathways.
Yes.
Yes.
And then the new land and water plan framework comes into being, and then all abstractors can apply for their new long-term consents. So it's in that sense, that's the scenario I want you to compare to the first one. And what I'm putting to you is that scenario is more efficient than applying for a substantive long-term consent now, land and water plan being put into place, and then going through a substantive review of that consent.
And I think it would be probably a case-specific situation. The benefit of having that discretionary pathway allows applicants to consider if they feel that they are in a position that they are able to go down that substantive consent process for a longer term, whether they what the circumstances of the case are and the risks associated with seeking that versus retaining that option to go down that controlled or restricted pathway for 6 years and then a reconsideration under whatever is unknown in the future. So it's about options rather than necessarily directing one way or the other. Those two options would remain available, and it would come down to an applicant to determine whether they think they could put forward an adequate case for a longer term now with, I would expect, provisions to deal with whatever effects there could be of that longer term.
But what you're suggesting is that an applicant should be free to choose in an efficient route rather than be directed towards a more efficient process. You're advocating for options rather than looking at it in terms of which is more efficient.
Yes, because efficiency will depend on what the drivers of the application may be.
And you're not considering what's more efficient in terms of the regional council as the regulatory and decision-making body either?
I don't know which would be more efficient because it's going to, again, depend on the case. It may be that having a two-stage consenting process, a simple rollover now and a big consent could be very costly and inefficient. In the light of an unknown future plan, I simply don't know which would be more efficient. Mm.
If the six-year rollover comes into being, those six-year rollovers would be done non-notified, wouldn't they?
My recollection is that the non-notification clause is still remaining against both the controlled and restricted.
Let's make an assumption, just for the purpose of this question, that the six-year rollovers are non-notified. And so,
yes,
in terms of participation in the consenting process by tangata whenua and other stakeholders, it's more efficient for those participants to go through have the six-year rollover just happen, land and water plan in place, substantive consent. That's more effective for those participants in the process than substantive consent now, land and water plan in place, substantive review of consent.
It could be, but the discretionary activity pathway for that greater term enables firstly consideration of who may be affected parties, so it would be possible, hypothetically, I suppose, to involve any parties up front, and whether a review is needed or the extent or scope or efficiency of a review in the future is a bit of an unknown of whether other parties may or may not need to be involved in that.
And Mr. Moore was asking you questions about how the discretionary proposition that you're putting up how it gets considered in the absence of any real policy direction, even just that proposition is less efficient than a substantive consent considered under the land and water plan that will contain the policy direction that gives effect to the NPS.
I don't know what will be in the new plan and how it will give effect to the various NPSs, so I don't know.
Okay. And then if they're, going back to scenario one, so substantive consent applied for now, and that's a long-term consent to, say, 2038, land and water plan in place, and for whatever reason that consent isn't reviewed, it's not until 2038 that the implementation of the NPS could be given effect to. So it delays implementation of the National Policy Statement Freshwater Management.
It would delay implementation of the effect of that in relation to those bits of renewals to, if there was not seen to be, for whatever reason, a review in the interim, and then would that consideration would be done holistically.
Mm. And in terms of these words that are in the objective at the moment, efficient and timely, that delay in implementation doesn't accord with that aspect of the objective as agreed on, does it?
I'm not sure that timely transition requires something to be done immediately. So this is about providing for efficient and timely transition into a new regime. Even the NPS FM itself doesn't say that all things will be done straight away. It's still got transitional expectations within it. So I'm not sure that it's necessary that all things have to be limited to 6 years to enable timely transition in the bigger scheme of things.
So I'm just interested in what your understanding of the use of the word timely in this objective adds to our understanding of it.
It's a fairly relative term given the extent of transitioning from what's in place now to the expectations of the NPS FM. What my understanding of the intent of that wording was to try to make a transition to the better regime in the best, most timely manner possible. So it was about doing things as well as they possibly can be done in the best timing possible.
Oh, thank you, that was helpful. Now my next set of questions relate to the National Policy Statement, Objective 2.1.
Sorry, which NPS? FM.
FM. And it was just arising from one of the answers you gave to Mr. Moore with general reference to the trust pair applications in terms of the races around Lake Mahinarangi. And when I look at Objective 2.1.1a in relation to the health and well-being of water bodies and freshwater ecosystems, I see that has two distinct elements to it. It's in relation to health and well-being of the water body and the health and well-being of freshwater ecosystems.
Yes.
Do you agree with that proposition?
Yes, it could be read that as two pieces. They're pretty closely linked.
Well, they're linked in the sense that the freshwater ecosystem lives in the water, but the water body itself is a distinct thing, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And if there's no water, there's no water body.
Correct. Well, no water at all, yes.
Yeah. So for the parts of a river that have been completely abstracted, for that reach of the river, that the water body no longer exists, it's been removed. You agree?
At the point of time, if there was no water, my hesitation is that my understanding in the context of the four Trustpower intake locations is that there's no surface water, but there's groundwater within the gravels, so the water body in itself is complex, and that in a very short distance after those takes, there's pools and flowing water due to various different reasons. And so, yeah, I'm not sure. If there was no water, there would be no water body, but in the circumstances that I think you're referring to with those cases, that's not quite that simple.
I accept that, but do you agree that Objective 2.11A also requires us to look at the health and wellbeing of the water body, not reducing it just to the freshwater ecosystem that lives within
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
Are you familiar with Edward Allison's evidence? Do you recall reading that?
I recall reading it some time ago. I am not familiar with it.
Could I get a copy of Mr. Allison's evidence?
No, thank you. Are you looking for the folder? Yeah, okay.
So while we're looking for that, I'm just going to also read you out some paragraphs from the transcript of Mr. Allison.
Mm-hmm. Hold on a second. It's document number 15 in the evidence files.
So the concern that I have is that without implementation of Objective 2.11A, there's a risk of a reductionist approach being taken, compartmentalising assessments rather than this looking at water body as an entity in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, I understood from Mr. Allison, one of his statements was, this is on page 503 of this.
My friend could wait for the evidence to be placed before the witness.
I was just trying to be efficient.
Yeah, but she won't be able to answer until it's in front.
No, I was going into the transcript. Okay. All right. Sorry, Mark. So you've got Mr. Allison's evidence?
Yes, I believe
good.
So.
If you go to page 10 and 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to draw your attention to particular statements from there that relate to the water body exclusive of, ecosystem values, if you like, just to make sure we're all on the same page.
Which paragraph are you reading from?
28 and 29.
Okay, so we'll just give you a chance to read that.
To read those,
we'll also read.
So, taking into account Mr. Allison's evidence, even just from that perspective, there are definitely elements of freshwater bodies that are distinct from freshwater ecosystems that need to be given effect to in the context of Objective 2.11A. Do you agree?
Yes, yes.
That's good. That's all I was trying to get clarified.
I can put that away.
Yes, thank you, Mum. Now, just going back to the joint witness statement, two versions of the objective again. So version A, that you support, compared to version B, version A contains no reference to any sort of environmental element of the objective, does it?
No.
But do you agree that there is an environmental element of Plan Change 7 being preventing further degradation associated with abstraction of water?
I understand that one of the purposes of the plan change was to hold the current historic use as the continuation through this process.
That's the use, but do you also agree that by holding the current use, it also prevents degradation associated with additional abstraction?
It
or would, caused by additional abstraction.
So this plan change doesn't enable additional abstraction, it enables the continuation of historical use. So effects would continue within the parameters of that use.
But the holding of the line of those effects is the environmental aspect of the objective of Plan Change 7, isn't it?
It has an environmental outcome, yes.
Yes. Do you agree it would be of assistance for the objective to express that environmental outcome that's being aimed for?
My concern with expressing that is that this objective in either form is about looking at a short-term outcome with multiple purposes. And if you tried to fit all of that within one objective, it could become rather complex and unwieldy rather than simply focusing on that short-term outcome of getting through a transition period.
Okay. Now, I just had a point of clarification about the relationship between the regional policy statement and the NPS REG that just wasn't clear from your evidence. It's at your paragraph, 6.12 is where you start to assess the RPS.
My evidence in chief?
Yes.
Yes,
sorry.
Yes.
And I just wanted to determine whether you turn your mind to, in your opinion, whether the RPS that we are now looking at, whether it gives effect to the NPS REG.
The RPS, as we currently have it, as I've quoted from and referred to and analysed, yes, gives at least partial, if not reasonable, effect to the NPS REG.
So you've qualified your answer. I mean, the RPS, NPS REG has been in place for a long time.
Yes.
I thought it was a simple question, but because it wasn't in your evidence, do you agree or not that the RPS gives effect to the NPS,
yes,
renewable energy generation?
Yes.
Okay, great. Thank you, Mum. No further questions.
re-examination?
Very short, ma'am. Ms Stiles, my friend Mr Moore was taking you through issues that might arise, or risks, as he put it, when the operative plan, I might use the words, has incomplete coverage, it's not fit for purpose, and the risks that might arise during the consenting in 104. What I want to ask is, in your opinion, do you believe that Part 2 has a role in 104 when dealing with a regional plan that has incomplete coverage as a mechanism of avoiding or mitigating that risk?
Indeed, I think it is very important where there's clearly inadequacies in the planning regime that do not give effect to current national direction to go back and look at the provisions of Part 2.
And the Supreme Court decision in King Salmon directs, or at least suggests that that is a permissible use to revert back to Part 2. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
All right. Mr Moore also asked you about locking up allocation. And I just want to think about hydro located in the upper catchments. When a hydro operator releases the water, is that water consumed and unavailable to downstream users or the environment?
In my opinion, and that's why I tried to explain within my evidence in chief, there's a difference between hydro's use of water and that return to the environment, not at the point that it was taken, but at some other point, and its availability to either other users or the environment after that point, which is why I was trying to draw the difference between something like irrigation as a consumptive use and hydro, which may be defined as consumptive, but is not the same in terms of its returning the water to become available again.
Yes, thank you, ma'am. That's all.
All right, well, we'll take the luncheon a break before we get to the court's questions. Thank you.
All rise.